do I get to Carnegie Hall? How do I get to Carnegie Hall? How do I get to Carnegie Hall? How do I get to Carnegie Hall?
You are listening to Conversational Comics, a three-panel speaker series sponsored by the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund and moderated by Bill Cartolopoulos. The following conversation was recorded on July 11th, 2009 at Union Pool in Brooklyn, New York. Today we're going to be talking about storytelling and fiction within comics, and we have a very accomplished panel with us today. I'd just like to briefly introduce them before we get into it. Going alphabetically, we have Jessica Abel, who began self-publishing her comic book series Art Babe, and then the fifth issue won a Zarek grant for self-publishing, and the series was subsequently picked up by Fantagraphics, and that featured mostly short-form comics, mostly fiction, which were collected into two books, Soundtrack and Mirror Window. Since then, she has published the graphic novel La Perdida through Pantheon Books and several other books, including a textbook about making comics that she co-authored with her husband, Matt Madden, who is also a cartoonist, among many other credits. And that book drew as well upon her experiences teaching about comics at SVA. So if we could please welcome Jessica Abel to today's event. Jason Little also is a Zarek grant recipient for his self-published comic book Jack's Luck Runs Out. He also published this graphic novel, Shutterbug Follies, and he has a sequel that's been completed and is forthcoming from Little Brown, correct?
Not anymore.
Oh,
I'll get to that later.
We'll get into that later. But there is a forthcoming sequel that's been completed and is viewable, I think, still online.
You can read an excerpt.
Okay. And he's also produced short-form work that's appeared in multiple anthologies, and he also teaches at the School of Visual Arts. So let's welcome Jason Little. And in the middle is Matthew Thurber, who's self-published several comics, and his current comic book series, 1-800 Mice, is currently running. The first two issues have been published by Picture Box. He's appeared in numerous anthologies, including Kramer's Ergot and the Gonsfeld, and his work's been in the New York Times, The Believer, Vice Magazine, and he also performs with his musical project, Ambergris, and co-curates with Rebecca Bird the Interesting Gallery, with air quotes around the word interesting, in Prospect Park South. So let's welcome Matthew Thurber. And we will begin. The first question I would like to ask, which is not directly related to our nominal topic, but just a very basic question, I would just like to hear from all the panelists just how they got into comics, both as a reader and then ultimately as an artist working in that form. Maybe if we want to stick with the alphabetical order, if Jessica, do you want to start with that question, just talking about how you got into this field?
Sure. I began reading comics as a little kid, basically anything that came across my path. I never collected comics per se until I was in my teen years, but as a little kid, I'd get, you know, three packs in the gas station of Casper the Ghost or whatever they had, and just was immediately attracted to the form and kind of stuck with me for a really long time. Not worth getting into all the details and detours that that took, but when I was when I got to college, my first year of college, I found Love and Rockets, which was the book that, you know, although I had kind of been heading in that direction of books that were more intellectually independent and, you know, non-genre based and all that kind of stuff, this was the one that made me think, wow, this is something I really want to do myself, and it started then basically drawing comics and doing them, you know, in classes or, you know, student anthologies and things like that for the next few years.
And had you been, before you sort of settled on what you're doing, in part based on that inspiration, were you writing and drawing, like, either separately or in combination with one another?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent. I self-identified as an artist, even then, didn't you know, but I did write some, and I did draw some, and you're looking at it now, I can see certain things that I did that were kind of pointing at making comics later, but at the time I didn't think of them that way. It wasn't my intention. Mm-hmm. I was never one of those people who was drawing little comics in my, you know, notebooks from the age of five or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. just something that, you know, sort of put together at that point. And I think, interestingly, for this panel, the thing that drew me into making comics was pure fiction, and what I started writing then was fiction, and didn't get into it. I mean, a lot of people assume that a lot of my work is autobiographical because, well, Leopardy is written in the first person and so on. But, who knows what the reasons are, but anyway, people assume that often. But it's not true. It's I've almost never done an autobiographical story more than maybe, you'll toss away one pager here and there.
And Jason, is that at all like your experience, or did you have a different experience getting into this stuff?
It's similar. I read comics. I read Tintin when I was a kid, and that carried me until I and like Jessica, I wasn't the R. Crumb mold type of young cartoonist where I would fill pages of sketchbooks with comics. I didn't really draw any comics at all until I took a class when I was about 10 years old at the Community Arts Center.
Although that's still pretty early.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess so. When did Crumb start doing those...
Toddler. Right, I think when those diapers that are sort of like shorts, I think those about the time.
Drawing them.
Yeah. ever since then, pretty much... And then, when I was a teenager, I started reading superhero comics and stuff like Swamp Thing and Spider-Man. And then shed that when I was an intern at Marvel, like right when I had achieved the grail of like working in the Marvel office is when I kind of stopped giving a shit about superheroes. And started reading Fantagraphics type comics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Matthew, did you also go through the Marvel Comics phase, or did you follow a different... path of development as a reader and then ultimately an artist?
I feel like I followed all these similar paths. Like, yeah, I was interested in Marvel and also newspaper comics, like Bloom County. I'd like get together with my friends and read the Far Side collection, the Far Side collected books. I feel like a lot of the early influences just came from peers, like my friends and I drawing together. My first comic was a direct ripoff of my friend Tom's series called The Killer Pigs. So I just copied him and drew like another version of it. I was like, oh, this can be improved. This can be like edited and made more like a Hollywood, you know, big budget movie. But yeah, the Tintin and, you know, the sort of Casper and Archie comics and stuff. I just took all that as well.
Mm-hmm. And did you do sketchbook comics when you were young? How old were you when you were doing the Killer Pig so much?
Like grade school, or the big Killer Pig comic that I did was I think 6th to 7th grade, okay. Like that summer.
Okay.
But when I was drawing with my friends, it was in grade school, and I drew with the same people in like middle school and high school. So it's all about that age.
Yeah. Did any of those young people continue to make drawings or narrative drawings of any kind, as far as you know? Did you just lose touch with them?
Oh, they make films now and stuff. It was all kind of like shared fantasy fun. Like we'd make movies together, and, you know, make videos. And that kind of, it was like a close circle of friends. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
So they're still all doing stuff or something?
Most of them. I mean, they're doing various things. My friend Raven is working on films, and my friend Tom did a film. I think it was just this mastermind, you know, like, work each other up, making stories up together.
Mm-hmm. Sort of thing. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It seems like there was a kind of shared interest in narrative, and that you sort of took it in the direction of comics, whereas other people went maybe more specifically into other media. Was there, and this is something I'd be interested in hearing from everyone from, going into comics, were there sort of types of stories and narratives from outside of comics that maybe influenced the kind of work you did in comics? Like you talked about how you wanted to make the Killer Pig more like a Hollywood kind of thing. Were there like film or literary kinds of influences that you were bringing to comics when you started making your own? Like seriously, as opposed, you know, in more recent years?
What were your aspirations?
Or no, just...
I was really into American independent filmmaking when I was in college. Hal Hartley, and my favorite film at the time was Scorsese's After Hours. And I feel like... You hate that movie? It's very polarizing. I mean, it's this very... In retrospect, it's kind of a fluffy film, but it's polarizing for some reason. And so, like, sexy young people in a sort of picaresque, somewhat humorous kind of narrative kind of had an impact.
Mm-hmm.
Was there something about the accessibility of 90s independent cinema? I mean, I remember books like you can make a movie using your credit cards. I mean, that sort of do-it-yourself spirit.
Yeah, I remember that floating around when I was in college too.
Because that's sort of what I feel like that was the same impetus that got me back into doing comics seriously. Like, you don't need anything. You can just cheaply make, like, an epic, you know, story that's like a movie, but it's even better than, like, making an independent film. I don't know.
Cheaper.
Yeah, cheaper.
Were you drawn into film?
As well, I mean, it's never been a real issue for me. Film has never been a huge influence in that way, but I hear a lot of people who do feel that way about film saying that what attracts about comics is the idea that you actually have control over the whole thing. You know, that you're the actors and the director and, you know, every other role in the filmmaking process, that you normally have to give up control over those things by having other people involved.
And that sort of speaks to the visual aspect of the medium, where people are sort of inspired by independent film because it's a visual narrative that seems to be autorial. But, of course, authors in prose are always auteurs. Were there any, like, literary influences that, Jessica, that you thought maybe you were bringing into comics?
I couldn't name anybody, like, super specifically, but in general, especially... my whole life, up until I became a serious cartoonist and then took my time for it, I devoured novels. You know, I just really like reading long fiction, and the longer the better. I like those big 1,200-page bricks, you know, because they last a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a really fast reader. So there's kind of a mishmash of influences, I think, but the kind of... You know, and it's such a cliche to say now, but even, you know, a long time ago, I was really into Jane Austen, you know, and that kind of, like, the really insightful depiction of relationships. I think it's not so much that that's an influence on my work, because I think it's going a bit too far to say that I'm somehow trying to be like Jane Austen in what I'm doing, but it reflects my interest in that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's there in Carmen Hernandez too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's there in a lot of authors that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure, I'm sure I'm influenced by them, but it's not like I'm anything directly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
Overall.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Jason? Did you bring any literary kind of influences into this?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that I was reading around the time when I commenced the body of work that I'm just coming away from now was lots of suspense stuff, like Jim Thompson and Chandler and Hammett, and then transitioning into more literary fiction by way of Paul Auster.
Mm-hmm.
But suspense was definitely the unifying theme.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some new writers whose work I have immense respect for and excitement about disparage the whole idea of suspense as kind of a cheat.
Uh-huh.
To bring you through a narrative, and so I'm kind of like trying to wean myself off that as if it were a crutch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Matthew, did you bring any particular kind of like novelistic or literary or short story sort of reading interests into your comics?
Yeah, I mean, I guess as much as drawing, I wanted to write, like, I mean, it's all kind of the same to me, but it's all different, like, ways of producing. But, yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, I liked fantasy and science fiction, and then, you know, now I love fantasy and science fiction, and, at some point, I, like, try to read important things like Ulysses and, you know, 20th century novels and boring 19th century novels and get in those big bricks and like, I don't know, experimental writers and Donald Barthelme or however you say his name, like that kind of, those kind of moods. And,
did it stick, or did you just go back to the science fiction?
Oh, no, it's all, now it's all mixed up. Okay. It's all just, like, I like all that stuff still. It's still, like, all the same stuff.
Yeah,
yeah, I should say that, too. Like, I've always read science fiction, not fancy stuff as much, but science fiction stuff, and that's something I'm working on right now, doing a science fiction story. And, you know, being able to have all that reading and watching from all these years to like bring those things in. And in some ways it's funny because like when I'm doing the work that's more literary in intent, like Leopard Eater or something like that, I'm not really thinking about influences at all. Like, and, you know, I'm certainly reading stuff for information, you know, like I read some stuff about the police force in Mexico City, for example, but it's like a nonfiction book. Whatever, that's what I'm reading, I'm just doing research for a book like that. But now that I'm doing a science fiction story, I'm actually reading a bunch of fiction and allowing that to kind of, you know, not the prose style, but like the kind of imagining the ideas to help me imagine the world that I'm trying to imagine. So it's, in some ways it's funny, it's like I'm willing to be more influenced by perhaps lesser work than, you know, the most serious stuff, like, you know, Gross or something
like that. It's a favorite of mine in college. It's like, you know, am I influenced by them? Yeah. No? Yes? I don't know. Maybe
they're somewhere, I guess.
You're letting yourself be influenced by kind of crap or by, like, pulpy
stuff? Not crap necessarily, but yeah, I mean, you know, most science fiction, not all science fiction, but most science fiction is kind of pulpy. Like, it's not written to the highest standard. You know, there may be great ideas in it, and it's totally fun to read. But it's, you know, in terms of the sentence-to-sentence structure of, like, a paragraph or something like that, that's not what it's about. It's about the ideas in it. So, like, I'm writing a story that takes place on Mars, so I'm reading Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, which I love. It's about 3 times too long. I mean, he repeats everything over and over again, and, you know, meets, like, some editor coming in and slices it to pieces, but it's amazing. I mean, his imagining of, like, the terraforming of Mars is incredible and makes me think so many things that, you know, help my story and help me sort of imagine Mars, like what Mars might be like.
Moving from influences to actual like invention when you're writing stories, there are a couple of different angles to approach it from, but one of them is character. I'm kind of interested in asking all of you, like, what makes a good character in your story, but also how that character is visually expressed. For example, Jason, in your graphic novel Shutterbug Follies, which you've also recently completed about an equally long sequel to, you've got a really strong central character who's like the real focus of all of the action, who's probably on every page. How do you construct a character who's going to be that central to your story? And then how does the way that you sort of design that character visually for comics inflect the way that character is going to be perceived?
Well, that character was constructed in the laboratory, so to speak, in that it was kind of, she was cannily constructed to suit an agenda, which is kind of a character building process that I don't necessarily advocate. And that I wanted, it was, there were sort of political decisions, like, okay, I'm going to do a suspense comic. Male or female protagonist? Female. Let's get some female readers. This is from a time when women weren't reading comics as much as they are now. And then, you know, how her body was shaped was also a political decision, like, let's approach this from a more sort of feminist point of view and have her, give her, like, a more real body shape. And then in retrospect, I realized that I cribbed her whole, like, grooming sense from, like, one or two issues of Love and Rockets where Maggie was wearing a stripy t-shirt and tight jeans and the same kind of hair. Like, I stumbled across that years later and I said, holy shit.
unconsciously,
yeah. Semi-consciously, who knows. But actually, yeah, I mean, if you look at that book, it kind of falls into the Tintin trap where the central character is really kind of the flattest character in the book. Where it's, I mean, you can rationalize that with sort of a McLeodian interpretation where you want the protagonist to be a little bit unrendered so that the reader can project their expectations and personality onto them. But I'm trying to get away from that a little bit.
And you talked a lot about figuring out what that character was going to look like. And I think you sort of, in a sideways way, kind of implied that it's maybe not the most fully developed character in the book. But what were the personality traits or defining characteristics of that character as you saw them when you were working towards that book?
Really simple and just kind of cribbed from Tintin and Mickey Mouse, like plucky, curious. That might be about it, actually.
Plucky, curious.
Plucky, curious. Lucky.
Realistic body shape.
Right.
Plucky
right.
and curious.
Yeah, no, I mean, just in terms of personality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. And Matthew, in your current series, 1-800-MICE, you have, like, tons of characters in this series. I'm not even sure. You published 2 issues so far. Is that right?
Yeah, the third one's done.
I'm not even sure, having read the 2 that have been published, like, necessarily who the main character is, and I don't say that as a critique. It's just that there are, I mean, it might be Peace Punk, but I'm not 100% sure because there are so many characters in the book. How do you develop these characters, and especially the way you're drawing them, like, they're all so different. Like, some of them are animals, like, they're mice, and there are trees, and there are humanoid figures, and there are all sorts of things. What makes a good character to you, and how do you decide how to visually represent that character?
Well, I feel like it's kind of the same thing Jason said. It's just taking the archetype of, like, in my case, it is directly a mouse character, because I thought I would just do the most obvious thing possible, which is make a comic book with a mouse central figure, because that's classic, and I thought of the title before the character, so then it had to be a mouse, and I guess in this world, I'm really trying to kind of develop this world, and it's very, there's no direct good or bad, and there are characters who are more active than others in like moving the plot along, but I wanted it to be like sort of realistic and have you be able to sympathize with all the major characters or sympathize with them up to a point. But yeah, I think like curiosity and sort of the drive to uncover like the mysteries of life or whatever is how I designed that character. So he's like the main character. I guess the main character is Groovy the Mouse.
Okay.
He's like got a job. He's sympathetic. He's got like a crappy job, or he sort of enjoys his job. And he's confused by the world that he's in, which is a similar position to my own position with the world or New York City or something. It's like I don't understand how this place works, and like I want to try and figure it out because it's like there's bad there's. Something is amiss, you know. So I your character was like very. I feel like maybe the main characters in Wapardia and Shutterbug Pollies, and they're all sort of like these detective. They're trying to figure out something that's more for themselves, or some mystery. Or detective characters, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't actually call Carla much of a detective. It's is never good at it.
She's on a quest.
Yeah, she's not plucky.
She's maybe more, she's definitely more complicated than, she's not an archetypal mouse.
No, and in fact, the way that I developed Carla, and this is typical of the way that I did most of the stories that form part of Archive, was to start with kind of an idea of a character's attitude to the world or something, some problem that's happening to this character, something like that, and then develop the character out from that. So the earliest notes I have are about creating a really negative, like really difficult character who's going to be really hard to sympathize with, and then like tricking the reader to sympathizing with her at the beginning of the book and kind of going from there. So,
how do you trick them?
Well, you make the character appear to be sympathetic and then reveal negative characteristics later on when it's too late in order to care about her.
Mm-hmm.
And, so she comes into this situation of being in Mexico, sort of like innocent abroad, and she's, you're like, oh, that's so great, good for you, girl, you're just heading down there to see what happens. And like, oh, yeah, crash with your ex-boyfriend, what the heck, he seems like an okay guy, well, maybe sort of. And then, she makes one bad decision after another, you start going like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I think is kind of a description of, like, many of my readers' reactions to her. And that's intentional, so that you really question her, and you want to sort of pull her back from this, abyss that she's pitching herself into. And I think that, I think one of the characteristics of Carla in contrast to somebody like Dee is just she is completely incurious. She doesn't really want to know what is around her. She wants to have her fantasies confirmed. But she doesn't really want to know anything, She's, she wishes that sort of everything would just kind of turn out the way that she hopes it turns out, and that's not really the way to live your life. And then to design it physically, basically I knew it was going to be a really long story, and I needed to design a character who looked like something, particular enough that I could, people would identify her and know where she was on the page and so on. But she's literally on almost every page of the book. Since it's a first-person book, everything that takes place has to take place through her point of view. Therefore, she's in every scene. And I knew I had to draw her a zillion times, and so I started out with some fairly complicated designs with curly hair, bumpy noses, and little stuff, and then chucked all that, and kept her super, super simple, so I knew that I could actually do it over and over again and not have her change radically from drawing to drawing. So that was actually a big part of the design. And of course, the hippie thing, at the beginning of the book, has to do with this naivete of her attitude towards Mexico. And as the book goes on, she becomes sort of stripped down less and less, kind of hippified as she realizes that this is not a function of the world that she actually lives in.
Mm-hmm. And you surrounded her with a lot of characters, too, and it becomes clear as one's reading the book that certain characters like are not good for her. It is friends or people who she has relationships with. Was that something that you had to be what is the balance of kind of cueing the reader with that information while at the same time not like over determining a response to a particular character?
Well, I'm just a big believer in dramatic action. Characters have to show you who they are through what they do. You can't just tell people, Memo's a really unreliable guy. If you say that, people do say that to Carla. She's like, fuck you. He's my friend. But when he does stuff that's unreliable and, stuff that's really negative and problematic, and I don't want to go beyond that, but that's, then she, at least at some subconscious level, realizes that that's the case, and later on acknowledges that she knows that that's the case,
mm-hmm.
that he is the person that people told her that she is. But if you don't show that happening, it doesn't take for the reader. There's no point, just telling people about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of overdetermining just was that you're not writing it well.
Mm-hmm.
Apropos of Memo, I think we've talked about this in the past, but did you... Was he inspired by a real person? Or
an assembly of people, but, nobody, it wasn't like I had anybody I knew well who was like that.
Uh-huh.
But, one time I was at a party, and this guy just started talking to me because I, you know, found out I was American and started just talking about how America was evil, and even like the most rightist Mexican politicians are more left than our most left Republican. I'm just like, yeah, okay, whatever. And I just walked away. You know, Carla would be like, no. You know, why did you get into this conversation with this guy? You know, like, prove yourself. And with me, I was just like, yeah, you're crazy. Go away.
So you feel like that was the germ of the character, that conversation you had with this dude?
It was part of it, yeah.
Did he have a big forehead? And
No, he didn't look anything like that.
Okay. Did you get his physical appearance from another person?
I don't remember where I got that from.
Okay.
I just made it up.
But
after the fact, when I came to New York and moved here, there was a bartender at Shunta who looked just like him.
Really?
Only person I'd ever seen looked just like him.
Okay. Well, because that's the way that I recommend building a character, is to just, like, pull them together from existing.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea that he would be, like, the long hair was this idea that he's sort of this, like, big radical, you know, and sort of wears his long hair, just kind of like a sign to society, but it doesn't really, you know, it's rare to see somebody who dresses, like, all hippie or whatever in Mexico, unless they're of an upper-class background. And his background is very sort of working class, lower middle class. Like, my idea is that his dad, like, ran a local newspaper in the north somewhere. Some, you know, that there's some kind of, like, literary background, but, like, at a very working class level. And that would dictate him dressing in a sort of ordinary way, which he does. Slightly flamboyant shirts every once in a while. I like that he kind of stoops over a little bit. You know, there's this kind of slouch that just has to do with his attitude towards the world. And then the profiles are something that I remember I came up with that I just really like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Oscar's more important to him because he's actually Indio. He's like, you know, much more, looks much more, you know, lower class, working class than Memo does. Although he's much better looking, he looks like an Indian. And in Mexico, that means that he can't have any, like, it's almost impossible to imagine a guy like him dressed the way that he is could be somebody who's smart, you know, considered, I mean, by society as being, you know, potentially somebody who would have, like, a powerful job or who would have any influence at all in society. And the idea that his dad owns a shop that installs, you know, aftermarket car alarms and stuff, you know, that's the kind of background that he has in, like, a really poor neighborhood. And that's really important, you know, like, in terms of the relationship of the characters, that he is somebody who societally has no power whatsoever. And so Memo likes to have him as this kind of, like, sidekick dude, because he's, like, good-looking and whatever, but he'll also do whatever Memo says, basically.
So a lot of what you're describing, I know that you and Matt lived in Mexico for a while, so this is, even though you didn't necessarily go to Mexico to do research for a book, what you ended up doing was accumulating a lot of information that made it into your fiction. And Jason, your book is set in a very, like, contemporary, although, like, cartoonified New York. Did you do a lot of, like, photo reference or research locations and things like that?
Uh-huh. Not enough.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've tried to invent architecture and trees and locations and stuff like that, and it always is unsatisfying. So the panels where I'm using photo reference for stuff like that, I feel like they're better drawings.
Mm-hmm. And how do you, but beyond being better drawings, do you think that the more research drawings serve the narrative better in some way, or do you think that's just invisible to the reader, but it's something that you notice because you live in New York?
It could be invisible to the reader, but it's something that I notice because I'm less inside the story unless I have stuff to reinforce the fantasy that I'm, you know, in the environment that the characters are in.
Mm-hmm. So it's about creating something that has a verisimilitude for yourself that you can work more confidently within?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Matthew, your current series is in, like, a totally invented world. How do you stay grounded within that?
I feel like it just needs to be as specific as using photo reference, even if it's in a fantastic place. I feel like it's like Al Jaffe chicken fat or whatever.
Oh, Will Elder?
Will Elder chicken fat,
yeah.
It's like the stuff in the background is like helps you stay located.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
You mean
it's,
like
it's an imaginary place, but it's also there's tons of like remembered New York-y type details in there, and like you know dogs that are specific to ones I've seen, or you know I will sketch things and sort of work them in, but I guess I wanted to be unfamiliar and familiar at the same time.
Okay, and how do you when you're sort of constructing kind of a world from whole cloth like that, is there a point where you feel like you've invested enough in it where it's going to seem real to the reader? Like, are there like things that you feel like you need to do to make it seem like this is all happening in a real place?
I think it just has to have its own logic or something. Like maybe that really only happens with time. Like, if a character walks past a building in one comic and then, you know, 50 pages later they go past the same building and it's going out of business or something, it's like remembering the time element, I don't know.
So it's like creating a functional system that sort of mimics kind of the patterns that we experience in day-to-day life, I guess.
Yeah, or not necessarily mimics them, but stays true to its own imaginings of patterns. And like, okay, maybe in this universe, like, you know, the streets are paved with coffee grounds or something. You have to remind people of that by having the coffee grounds on people's feet when they put up their feet when they're sitting at the table, you know, or something.
And internally consistent.
Internally, which is, that's all that I'm thinking about, like, when designing this universe. Like, how can this be a more perfect system?
It's like writing sci-fi.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm like, you know, I'm trying to write like about a Martian society, and I'm trying to think of like how things, you know, make decisions about what things that are really taking place, like that they're true about Mars. For example, the gravity I'm not dealing with, but there are things like the fact that it has really high solar radiation that I am dealing with. So make these decisions, and then the radiation issue has to be dealt with every single page. Like, you can't just stop every once in a while. So be walking around in a bathing suit outside, like it's 40 below Celsius, and you know there's solar radiation. So you know that has to be built in, and it's the same kind of thing with coffee grounds and streets. Like, you have to know that, remember it, and use it every time. And I think that a world like yours has a greater responsibility to the reader in some senses, because you have to establish all the parameters of the world, you know? Like, I'm talking about Mexico City. You guys haven't necessarily been there, but it's a city that's on Earth in our normal world and goes by many of the normal rules. New York City, same thing. A world that we've been, you have to set all the parameters for us.
Yeah, or if you're drawing New York, you could change things and it could still be your version of New York.
Yeah.
Just like your, funny because it diverts from the actual things you would see. Or
those are right.
Right.
Did you feel like you took any acceptable liberties in your depiction of a kind of fantasy version of New York?
No, it's more just like cartoon simplification. Like, if a building has like 7 columns, I'll put 5 columns in the front of it, stuff like that. I'm toying with if there's going to be a third B book,
taking her on the road.
It would be set in a library, and I was thinking about making a fantasy New York public library that was the Astor Library on Lafayette Street before it was closed. It's currently the Joseph Papp Public Theater. But I wanted to create this alternate history where that library never was decommissioned. So that's very speculative, but that's sort of an example of a divergence that I would take.
Well, that goes into like whatever. What do they call that category? It's like his alternate
history,
right?
Which is really—that's a really interesting wing. That maybe that's the most strenuous of all, or something.
Right.
You have to.
What would have had to happen in order for this library not to have closed?
Right.
And do you deal with that, or just be like, "Oh well, it closed."
And Matthew, I just wanted to ask you one last question just about like the world of your current series. As kind of fantastical and invented as it is, there's a note in your first issue that the story was at least partially inspired by a comment that someone made to you, maybe at Flux Factory. Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
So what is the real comment that sort of, and how did it like inspire this kind of world that seems like it was made out of whole cloth.
Oh, well, it was just a suggestion. I guess I was talking about making comics that had some attention paid to, like, the current ecological crisis. And I was wondering how I could do that, but still, like, have fun and be lighthearted or something. And my friend Steve Schmitz, who's a writer, was like, oh, maybe you should, you know, have trees be characters. And that was kind of like, that and the idea, like, that was the spark of the whole story. It's like, okay, trees are going to be the characters. They're going to be walking around. They're going to be sharing the ecosystem of the city with the people or the other, you know, they'll be part of the ecosystem. It's like they can vote. And actually then they became like sort of the Chamber of Commerce or something in the city. So that was the inspiration for the story. That and the title, 1-800-MICE, which I just thought of on the subway. Like,
Doctor Dismore.
Something. Yeah. I don't know. I was just like, oh,
1-800 divorce.
Yeah, 1-800. Something. Just like a service that you could call.
Are you influenced by John Lewis at all?
Oh, True Swan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love his. I mean, he kind of makes ecosystem comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like it's all.
Yeah.
You know, it's all contained.
Because the passage in the first issue, where they're talking about a tree, a character's half tree and half human, that left off the page. Like, oh, this guy's been John Lewis, the second time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even like the Wizard of Oz, or you know, the ants in Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like an old fairy tale sort of idea. But yeah, John Lewis, I love his comics.
And what also links it is that your dialogue feels very sophisticated in a very similar way to John's. Like, he's got a really strong, writerly voice, and I think I'm seeing a lot of that with you, too.
Yeah, he's a really good writer. He's a big Sun City Girls fan, too.
That's what you're picking up on. I should start listening to that band more.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask, because there's obviously a lot of interest in like the so-called graphic novel these days. All three of you have started out doing short-form work, and all three of you have either completed at least one long-form piece of work, or I guess in Matthew's case, you're working on a long-form piece of work. And I'm curious about how what that transition is like in terms of plotting out story arcs in advance, particularly when a work is being serialized. I know La Perdita started out being serialized in comic book form, and it's like by far the longest piece of work that you've written and drawn yourself. Was that a huge change for you in terms of thinking about story, going from the relatively shorter pieces in Art Babe, although those were sort of getting progressively longer as you were going, I think.
Not that long, not
but
long,
yeah.
Long
like 20 or so pages, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really different. I mean, there's sort of two questions there. One mm-hmm. is, what's the difference between working on long form and short form comic? And the other is, what's the difference of serialization?
Seriality, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the thing about long form work, to me, that especially in retrospect, understanding what it was like for me to work on it, the thing that was really appealing is this idea that you could push your characters harder, you could push them further. Like, you can't fit the kind of crisis that I fit into La Perdita into a short story. Or you can, but it's completely fake feeling. You can't, like this thing with dramatized action, you can't truly get your characters to all make themselves understood as who they are and what their motivations are in time in order to make something like that make sense. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see where it's coming from and why it happened, even if you don't want it to happen. And I'm, you know, really in case anybody hasn't read it, but and so that's a big difference, and that's something that I really like about working long form, which is now basically what I'm doing most of the time. In terms of serialization, I think it's got upsides and downsides. The upsides are I finished the book because I was able to put it out piece by piece, get a little bit of money, get a response, and do all this stuff, and also have individual deadlines where I just have to put out this one book, and I can put out this one book, you know, and that way did the book. And if I'd had to sit down and do the entire thing all at once beforehand, I'd probably still be working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or not working on it, more to the point. And I also don't know whether, you know, Pantheon would have published it if it hadn't had already been out there and had critical response and all that stuff. So that all those things are really important. Mm-hmm. But they're all technical things. They're not creative things. Creatively, I think it would have been better to do it all ahead of time, do a lot more comprehensive editing on it and the way one does with a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, especially in chapter one, there's just a lot of stuff in there that I would have done differently if I'd done it knowing what I was doing in chapter four, chapter five. Now, I knew what the full arc of the story was, mm-hmm. but I did not know the details.
Mm-hmm.
And the details are, you know, obviously really important.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that if you had not serialized it, but theoretically, which is, I mean, it's hard to speculate, but if you had just sort of done it as a complete piece of work intended to be shown to the world all at once, that you may have structured it differently instead of breaking it down into these sort of long chapter, self-contained chapter chunks of story?
I mean, I still believe in chapters. I really like chapters. I think that chapters really help help readers. It helps the writer structure things, you know, and put in turning points and push the story along.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, give you a little, it gives you a moment to put the book down and not read it anymore for a while. And I mean, I like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably would have done something like that. I mean, they might have been shorter, more shorter ones.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you know, like the thing I'm working on now, I'm still thinking in terms of, you know, each scene has its own wholeness to it and should have some kind of turn at the end, and then each sort of like, you know, sequences of scenes that are essentially like chapters. They may not have, you know, a chapter break, but I'm still thinking about it that way.
And Jason, you did a lot of shorter work before you did the Shutterbug Follies book as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the shorter work seems to proceed often from a kind of formal visual conceit, whereas this is the Shutterbug Follies book is a little bit more directly propelled by narrative. Was that a sort of a transition for you? Did it require a new way of thinking about what you were working on?
It was more like envisioning two simultaneous careers that would continue parallel, the experimental formalism and the you know, straight stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the straight stuff took so much work that I abandoned the experimental thread.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm desperate to get back to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't difficult to move into that sort of straightforward storytelling mode, because the page unit was borrowed so much from Hergé.
Mm-hmm.
With this this cliffhanger at the bottom of every episode, that it was just easy to just kind of like turn that machine on and go with it.
Mm-hmm. So you drew very heavily on the Hergé influence in terms,
yeah,
of like the clarity of storytelling,
yeah,
and the,
yeah,
pacing.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And when you're talking about the end of every episode, you mean almost literally, I think, like the two-page spread, which you sort of ran, mm-hmm, stacked up, I guess.
Right, on the web, the wide pages were stacked one on top of another, so a spread in the book becomes a episode on the web.
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so that episode is the same as a Hergé page, four tiers, just about, with a cliffhanger in the last panel.
I see. And so, did the fact that you were serializing affect that pacing with the kind of periodic cliffhangers, or is that something that you would have done anyway because that's just the way Hergé paced his books?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to really perceive the overall shape of the book because there is that just sort of like one page at a time shape.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit blind to the overall shape of the book, other than that there, you can find conventions in it, just like, you know, exposition, development, climax, denouement, stuff.
Mm-hmm. I just want to sort of ask Matthew the same question, because you've had some short pieces in anthologies and some sort of self-contained mini-comics and things like that. Now you have this series that you're working on that's telling a longer story. Like, did you map this out? Do you have a kind of shape to your narrative, or are you finding it as you go along? How is that working for you?
Yeah, both. I guess I thought of it as being like a soap opera,
mm-hmm,
that would just go on and on and on. That's why all the characters are kind of equivalent, you know, just keeps cutting back and forth between these different episodes. But, like, so I thought of it as a soap opera, but also, like, Shogun, the miniseries, where it would be, like, a four-part, or it would appear on TV, like, once a week for, like, 8 weeks, and then it would be over. So, like, a self-contained soap opera miniseries. And, yeah, I know how it's going to end, like, I spent a lot of time, but...
The telenovela.
Yeah, it's like, you know... Yeah, and, oh, I was inspired by, like, English soap opera, too. I don't know, there's this one called EastEnders, which has these... It's like, you can't really understand it. It's better watching soap operas in other countries because it's more incoherent, and you can project more into what you might be seeing. Like, there's a nurse in a tent or something, and, like, opens up a case with a syringe in it or something. I don't know. So... Telenovela. I know how it's going to end. There's a banjo contest in the end.
you just ruined it for me. Yeah. But we don't know who wins.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter who wins because it's all inevitable, you know. You know.
It has to be a banjo contest.
Yeah, what's the inevitable ending? But I actually spent a lot of time mapping out this insane... Because I started from all these stupid precepts, like, this is going to be like this, this is going to be like this, and then I have to weave them all to make them all work out right at the end, so I'm spending a lot of time, like, plotting things in this retarded way, like, trying to make it all weave back together, because, like, I can't work on something that doesn't resolve itself, but also, I always have to start with these absurd premises, like the title,
and the banjo contest.
And, yeah, like, this has to be in there.
Are you giving yourself a lot of freedom to discard some of those presets, if it just becomes a block?
You know, I kind of have to, like, use them all.
Wow.
Also, like, once you publish the thing, and this is what happened with Bacardita, it's like you put together these, the precepts that I was working with were not ridiculous, but they were hard to achieve, you know, in some senses. But, like, you set it up, you publish the first issue, gotta be something, you know, you have to somehow get it there, which is sort of the issue, the problem, and also the motivation of serialization.
Yeah, I mean, serial form is so good for advancing something slowly. Like, I really thought of this as being like a comic book series, and now it got me really hung up trying to think of it as a graphic novel. So basically, I'm going back to self-publishing issues because that's the only way I can kind of advance it at a regular. Because otherwise, I'd disappear for like 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like just
we just, we just watched Little Dorrit, like a, you know, TV version, PC version. Dickens is great at this stuff. And you look at it and you have to think, like, this came out weekly or whatever it was over a period of time. There's all these cliffhangers, these crazy characters, all this crazy stuff happens. When you think about it, it's like it's the comic book of its day. It really is. And I love, you know, Uldor is like, it's such a crazy story. So all this wacky stuff happens, but it's also really charming. And there's a lot of real insight into human behavior. And, It's really
scary. They're all completely caricature. Like they're,
yeah, they're not all, but they're not all like that. Some aren't. Even ones who are, they still have humanity in them. You know, they're still, and that's, I think, you know, a goal for me when I'm doing work that's more, you know, it's less realistic and more genre or whatever, is to have, there's an element of caricature into the characters because they fulfill X role or whatever, but they also have some spark of real humanity in them. Mm-hmm.
We're sort of, you've been talking a little bit about how you have been kind of thinking about working on these long-term stories, and it seems like there's this, you know, destination, even if you don't know how you're going to get there, and that provides something like an arc. And I know that, Jessica, in the book that you co-wrote, Drawing Words and Writing Pictures, you talk a little bit about how you sort of struggle to understand story structure, and you eventually found it in Archie. What exactly was that experience for you in terms of trying to crack the code of how to actually map out some kind of story arc?
Well, it's a sorted story. Look, you know, there are a lot of books out there, starting with very, very old ones, that talk very explicitly about story structure and different ideas of story structure. There's not only one way of doing it, of course. But for whatever reason, I had never, in my 20s, I'd never read any of those books. And I kept making comics that I was trying to make them feel like they had this something to say, and they had some kind of sense of ending to them, and some feeling of structure. But and occasionally I would stumble on something that would work that way, but it was accidental. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to do that. And but I really, really wanted, you know, I wanted my stories to feel like complete and satisfying and whole the way, you know, kind of Hernandez stories feel, you know. So there's only one, but there's certainly plenty of people to do that. And I happened to be at a launch party for an issue of Black that Terry LeBan was in, and he was at the party. And this is when he was just about to start the series Cud, which I don't remember the name of the series, but it was very funny. And so we're sitting around, standing around the keg, and he's like, yeah, I said, well, what do you have to do? I've been reading a lot of Archie's. And I said, okay, why? And he talked about having this, like, really perfect, crystallized story structure, which you can totally see, you know, just right out there on the surface, and he did such a great job of just kind of, all the parts of the story are all there. And it turned out when he started his series Cud, he's also, you know, creating the style and like the characters kind of based on cartoon characters and all this other funny stuff. But I went out the next day and got a book of Archie comics and read them. I'm like, okay, so tell me something. And it was really only just the first glimmer of information about how to sort of structure story, but I wrote down kind of like what happened in this sort of chart form in each story and came up with this idea that the conflict had to be motivated out of the character. Like, the character's strengths and weaknesses are somehow going to be the thing that caused the conflict to come up with the story. Mm-hmm. And then the resolution is to tie to that also. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, very minimal understanding.
Right.
But it was the beginning of under, you know, trying to put it all together.
So from that, you got the kind of basic sort of armature of the story.
Not even armature. Just, I mean, because then that I was doing that. I read that and did that little chart, those little charts, right as I was, like, just starting the first of the four stories in Isaiah issue, mm-hmm. the fifth issue of my self-published record. Mm-hmm. And those stories show the influence of this, these ideas, which is to say they kind of have the, like, New Yorker-style story you know, that there's like, and I'm not really sure how I got from Archie to that, but somehow those things were connected to me, where it's like there's a character who needs something, and then something happens to that character in the course of the story that changes the character a little bit in some way, or causes the character to realize something, or whatever. And if you look at the various stories in Archie, in the second volume of Archie, they all have that kind of epiphany structure.
But because of Archie, no one ever changes.
No, and that's the thing. Right? I don't know how I got from one to the other. Clearly, I wasn't going one to one. But something about, like, it has to be the main character who has some characteristics that cause the story to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, and that led me into the first story structure chart that I did when I started teaching, which I don't use now. I mean, I've changed it around, but it was like there's a character with some existing conditions, including characteristics of personality and so on. And then there's a new condition that comes in, which I now call the spark, or we call it the inciting incident or whatever, but I didn't call it then. That then, which causes the character to react in some way and then go through the story. And, you know, somehow do something has to do with that new condition. And that's just kind of, that was like the next stage. And then after that, you know, like, write a bunch of books about it, and, you know, eventually get to the point where I have pretty much the understanding of it that I think most people have, but, you know, but it took forever to figure that out. And I found it really shocking. The main thing is I found it really shocking that nobody ever told me any of this stuff. It's not like it's a major secret, you know, but, like, I was an English major in school. It never came up, you know? I took a creative writing class, I took a screenwriting class, and nobody talked about this. You know? Why should we not, you know, as people were trying to train, if you're trying to train fiction writers, shouldn't this at least get mentioned? Like, oh, this is so old-fashioned, but here, have it anyway, you know? Like, why not? Why shouldn't we know it?
And so that's sort of finding the kind of a character-based story arc where there's like a transformation by the end of it. And Jason, you had mentioned earlier in our conversation that your character is more of like a Tintin type, who's maybe, I think you said, the flattest character in the story.
Yeah, Transformation is not really part of that.
Yeah, not, like, transformative. But what's kind of interesting about that is, like, it sort of brings up two things. One is that the character is a cartoon character. Mm-hmm. And the other is that you talked about how you were reading sort of genre thrillers.
Yeah.
Does the use of that kind of genre armature sort of change the rules of the game a little bit?
It certainly reinforces that tabula rasa kind of protagonist. Mm-hmm. That, like, the extreme example is the Continental Op stories by Hammett? Chandler? Hammett, I think. Where it's a first-person narrator, and he's the detective, but the gimmick of the stories is that he reveals nothing about himself at all.
Mm-hmm.
Except for once in a while, the author will slip in a little something just to tantalize you. Like, you know nothing about him at all. And then he says, and then I scrambled down the hill in pursuit of the perp and got down there pretty quickly for a man my size and age.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, suddenly there's an image there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to get away from that.
Kinda. Okay.
It's like, it's limiting. Like,
but, I mean, the thing is, it's all the same structure. I mean, the fact that I was using it in this way...
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing RFA, it doesn't mean that it doesn't also apply when you're doing suspense stories. And you still have characters who are presented with some kind of issue or problem, and it causes them to need to do something or, you know, resolve it in some way or another, and then therefore they, you know, put the story and figure it out.
I think the key difference is, like, whether it's the epiphany, whether the character changes, like you said,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's just, like, a plot. Like, a suspense story is just, like, can just be a plot, and, like...
Right.
I know...
Yeah, talk about, in drawings and pictures, we talk about that in terms of character types, so you have an archetypical or archetypal character who doesn't change, like an archy character, and then you have a naturalistic character who does change, and that's just... Yeah. It doesn't affect the fact of this... the possibility to use this kind of narrative structure... But it does affect what actually happens to the character. Does the character change or not change? Are you watching The Simpsons? Are you watching, you know, I don't know, The Wire? You know, yeah. It's like the...
Is there, like, masks? But, like, I always think in comics it's like you're drawing, like, a mask anyway. Like, your characters are kind of, like... They can't think as fast as in prose fiction or whatever. It's not like in a comic you see all this internal monologue anyway, so... You kind of never get inside the characters totally. So I'm always, like, wondering, like, you know, is it worth it to, like, have this illusion of a character that you is thinking thoughts, or is it just, should it just be, like, a bunch of masks, people in masks running around doing, should it be more about, like, what happens, like, the plot, you know, or, so, very confused by this research into this.
All right, and on that note, we'll all, maybe confuse ourselves further at the bar. I would like to thank all of our panelists for being here. If you could join me in thanking them for coming.
This has been Conversational Comics, sponsored by the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, moderated by Bill Cartolopoulos, and hosted by Union Pool in Brooklyn, New York. Join us again on August 15th to talk about drawing and cartooning with Austin English, Lisa Hanawalt, and Dash Shaw.
Practice. Practice. They loved it. They showed it.
The audience was deafening.
I was ready. I was ready.
The critics all said riveting.
On the Steinway. On the Steinway.
I guess it doesn't mean a thing.